Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Hello, good morning and welcome on this Saturday, the 11th of July. I hope you're well. I'm Kit Hogg and with me in the studio this morning is Janie Jewson.
Good morning, all you lovely people.
Is ready to entertain the Costa del Sol.
Yeah, we're right up for it.
Now, if you were in Camino with us last Saturday, you may have heard Coiby's postcard from Galicia, in which he referred to the huge tidal range of the sea up there, something we just don't get down here on the Med, where there appears to be no difference between high and low tide. Although, Janie, you think there is a difference.
Well, there is where I am, which is just in from the stretch of the Gibraltar Strait.
Like, what is the difference in metres?
Not much. It's
like
not much, but you do
something?
Notice. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see the actual level, but, you know, it does go out. It doesn't go out far, like in Weston-super-Mare, for example.
Weston-super-Nightmare.
Absolutely.
Anyway, as we mused on this question of tidal range and the immensity of the tidal range in Galicia and Weston-super-Mare, Coy said something about tides being controlled by the moon. And this stirred a faint memory of something that I once understood, now forgotten, mislaid in a brain that, like as not, is shrinking. But over the course of this week, I've become curious to rediscover how the moon, of all things, exerts a defining influence on the reach of the sea here on Earth. And I mean, I wonder, Janie, if you have... I don't want you to tell me the answer now, but give me a yes or no answer. Do you have a grip on that question?
No.
Okay. In search of the answer, therefore, I went to see Terence Michaels, the sage of the Serenea, who kindly agreed to explain this curious phenomenon on the show. And so that's Terence, the tides and the moon coming up in less than 30 minutes from now. While we're on the beach, whether it's high tide or low, on the part of the show we call Things That Grow, Janie extols the freely compostable benefits of
seaweed.
Very good. While I impart a 19th century recipe for gazpacho. And in this all too modern day and age when locations and destinations are the property of sat-nav, we get nostalgic for the lost conversational art of giving directions. It's an eclectic mix, a random assortment, a curate's egg. It's your Saturday supplement live here on TRE.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
And Janie Jewson. Janie, I asked you this 2 weeks ago when we last met, and it's still going on. How's your World Cup going?
Oh, my goodness, I'm absolutely loving it. I am not a football fan. I don't watch football, never played the game, think it's rather stupid, don't understand, really, still the offside rule. But watching my country, you know, where I come from, and Spain here as well, battling it out amongst all the other countries on the TV with thousands and thousands and thousands of other people is riveting. I'm loving it.
You've got a very big TV with thousands of people around, or is it just the idea that there are thousands of people?
Well, you can see them on the telly.
Ah, yes, of course. Yes.
There were, I think, 78,000 watching the match last night between Spain and Belgium.
Right. So
it actually said full house and gave the number.
And were they all having a nice time?
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, the thing is, there's a whole range of emotions, isn't there? And you get this sort of elevation of absolute joy and screaming and hurrahs and clapping and jumping and everything. And then on the other side, you get this rather morose-looking, yes. Terribly sad, forlorn, the world that's the end of the world look.
Absolutely, yeah, I love that. It's a vivid portrayal of extremes of human emotion, isn't it?
So is. It illustrates everything and how we all go up and down. It's all about finding the middle ground, isn't it, Kit?
I think, you know, to watch the World Cup or to commit going to the World Cup, it's like a sojourn, it's like a pilgrimage. You have to follow your team from location to location. And you never actually know in the knockout stages whether that's going to be the end of the journey.
I suppose it is. I've never done it.
You don't book hotels for the next place or travel arrangements for the next place until you know that you're through.
It must be very expensive to get one of those last-minute flights home.
Massively. Well, the whole thing, I think, is massively expensive, particularly being in the States. Anyway, good news from Mexico City, and I'm not referring to England's recent classic win at the Azteca. This is a happy animal story. It happened very close to the Azteca and the Azteca Stadium. A beloved dog, missing for a whole month, was reunited with her owner when she was found partying with fans after Mexico's group stage win over the Czech Republic.
Oh, how sweet!
Yeah, isn't that sweet? The pooch was in the barrio of Tamaulipas, some 9 miles from where her overjoyed owner last saw her. Ali Garcia and her six-year-old dog, La Gorda, are now reunited.
Oh, so she was a secret Mexican football supporter.
La Gorda?
Yes.
I guess so, yeah.
Well, she said she was there reveling with the revelers.
She was partying, yeah. Yeah, she probably didn't know what was going on. Hey, Bernie! Yeah, anyway. From football to vehicle maintenance now.
Oh, no.
It's the thought of vehicle maintenance, Janie, that you actually indulge in, because your car is spotless.
Oh, rubbish.
And I can remember putting some shopping in the back of your car one day, and you said, is the bottom of the shopping bag dusty?
Oh, for heaven's sake. It's not that clean at all.
I want to ask you how often you valet your car.
About once every 2 months.
Okay, well, you're obviously a very clean person. Actually, not having a dog is a huge...
Oh, God, no.
Since I no longer have Brewery, I keep looking at my car, the interior of it. The other day, I was showing it to a friend. He opened the door and said, "Ooh, it's clean in here." No one's ever said that to me about a sort of car that's generally encrusted with dog hair.
So, and they are disgusting and they can smell terribly badly.
What?
A dog-infested car.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are limits, obviously. But so, I've discovered this place anyway, and it's a curiously blokish place.
A valeting place?
Yes. Well, because I haven't seen any women there. I mean, presumably women are allowed in. And maybe you've even been there. It's in Torre Guadiaro.
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, all right. It's a little ways off the road, but I mean, this is a place where men go to worship their cars.
Okay, but Kit, don't have your car valeted ever, do you?
I have. Yes, I've actually hoovered it out before. I tend not to wash the outside because it just gets dusty often. Mm. But it's nice to have a clean interior.
It is.
I'm more fastidious about the interior of my car than the interior of my house.
Oh,
it
dear.
Might surprise you to know.
Doesn't actually.
Anyway, so this is maintenance, and I have to qualify that there are no oily rags or spanners or knuckles skinned on rusted bolts, no draining of sump plugs or changing of filters. Nothing quite as hardcore. This is to this place to which men in cars are drawn is car cosmetic. It's a haven of high-powered lance guns that power a kickback jet of steaming suds in the general direction that you're pointing, ranks of industrially rated vacuums capable of swallowing small rocks, and tyre pressure air hoses that actually work. I mean, how often do you check your tyre pressure?
Probably not often enough. I just look at them and do sort of like finger measurement. You know,
what do you mean finger measurement?
Well, you sort of test how far the bottom of the wheel is to the rim.
Ah, okay.
Well,
okay, I've never heard anyone doing that. But having said that, tire pressure things are really unreliable and very difficult to organise, particularly if you're on your own.
Oh, those stupid machines. Oh, God. I did one the other day where my tire had gone, it had a slow puncture, and I went in and I tried one of those spray-in things where it fills up the tire with foam and it's supposed to refill it. Then you go to the garage or you pump it up straight away. But I'd done it so that the valve absolutely sealed itself up. So I was stuck in this garage trying to repeatedly pump up the tyre and it wouldn't pump up at all.
Well, it was full with that coagulant kind of foam.
Yeah, it wouldn't pump up at all. I ended up having to change it.
Oh, it's a gimmick. It's a gimmick. Anyway, let me get back to this place because it's called Eco Wash. It's in Torriguardiato. And, of course, there's nothing remotely eco about it at all. There's nothing remotely eco about gallons of detergent-infused water spilling down the drain, and nor do sales of cheap gasoline fulfil any green credential. But what's in a name? What the heck? They call themselves Eco Wash.
And actually, I know that one. Now you say it. I've seen it and wondered, what on earth is eco about it? I've never used it.
Well, I'm telling you that I can't find anything eco about it at all. But for the blokes absorbed in this cosmetic ritual with their favourite toy, their car, the resulting improvement in morale as they potter, preen, polish, pamper, and then drive down the road grinning as they gleam. I mean, this improvement of mood has to be good for the planet on some level or other.
Maybe mentally, for men.
Mental cleanliness.
Yes.
Next to godliness,
yes.
Maybe.
Yes.
I mean, the environment apart, cleanliness at Eco Wash comes at a price, of course. And the challenge here is to get as best value as you can from the slot machine that is, in this case, it is regulating the duration of my vacuum cleaner, yeah?
Okay, I'm so sorry, but at the beginning I thought you meant you went in, you paid someone to clean it for you, but you're actually doing it yourself.
No. There's all these little booths, you see.
Okay.
And busy blokes in golf tops.
Well, they're the valeters, you see. You won't
No, they're
your
not
car
the valeters, darling. They're the point of this place.
Self-appointed valeters.
They're the point of this is that you do your own car.
Okay. Oh, we're going to be on this subject a long time. Sorry. I'm slowing down the schedule.
It's exciting, I know.
It's thrilling.
Anyway, I know that the obvious precursor to activation is to empty the cabin of your car, of everything. So before you hoover it, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's ropes, toolboxes, first aid kits, floor mats, the family dog, and don't forget the small perishables like loose change, receipts, sunglasses, and other dashboard encumbrance, which will disappear forever into the bowels of the vacuum, never to be seen again. So stow them away in a console or the glove box, okay? So now you've got your car ready to hoover. And with your belongings in a pile outside the car, inspect the vacuum cleaner itself. Have you parked in such a way that via its flexible hose, it will reach, the end of it will reach the nethermost nooks and crannies of the interior where dog hair, sunflower seeds and bits of grit accumulate?
don't know. I don't know.
No, just it's a rhetorical question, Jamie. So if you... Come on, you must have used one of those vacuum cleaners before. Or do you do it at home?
To be honest, I do it all at home.
Okay. And yes. Your vacuum cleaner is strong enough?
It's a Henry. It's 45 years old and it's still going strong.
Okay. Yep. I know the Henrys. Yeah.
Yep.
I've got a horse called Henry. And while you're here, check the fitting on the end of the cannon. You know, the end of the...
Yeah, the pointy bit. Yeah. Can have a pointy bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it round, which is ideal for sucking dust out of cup holders, or is it a flat nozzle, which is what you'll need in the narrowings of the door sills? Ideally, have both to hand. And you'll be able to change them without fluster during the course of the operation, while the clock's ticking. Having made these essential preparatory checks, you're now ready to activate. Now, this is an exciting moment, which is temporarily deflated when you discover that you've got no euro coins to post into the vacuum slot machine. At this point, take heart, keep going, because what you need to do is find Manuel in the high-vis slithery orange T-shirt. This is EcoWash regalia.
So all that first part was all about preparation. You're not actually doing it yet.
I haven't activated it yet because I've run out of euro coins. So I'm now looking for Manuel. Yeah, Manuel, don't look down. And however unpleasant a look in workwear, this his eco orange slithery top is, it does mean that he stands out in the crowd, in the general melee of men in golf tops and machines, yeah? Manuel has change in his satchel, and it's a bit like being at the ferry. You never know quite how many goes on the dodgems your kids will want. So aprovechar, as the Spanish say, make the most of Manuel. I came away with 5 Eurito coins, which buys a total of 10 minutes riding the vacuum.
Whoa.
Obviously, life's too short to be on a Hoover for so long. But it's odd how time flies when you're doing something really satisfying.
Oh, God, get a life, Kelly.
From Miss Clean Car, that comes a bit rich, Jenny. Your car is so clean.
Oh, you've obviously been living on your own for too long, but carry on.
You can say that again, yeah. Yes, someone who's not living on his own is the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese.
Oh, hang on a minute. Did you get the car nicely cleaned?
Yes.
It's finished.
We moved on now.
Job done.
Yeah,
right,
job done. And as I said, someone who doesn't live on his own is Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who apologises unequivocally for a podcast comment this week about Kylie.
Oh, Miss Minogue.
Kylie Minogue, yeah.
Oh, Mrs. now.
And he was playing a dubious game, which you can't imagine. I mean, he's the Prime Minister of Australia, yes? So he's playing a game called Shag, Marry and Date on a comedy podcast. He named Kylie as being numero uno in all 3 categories. So the Australian Prime Minister issued a statement on Monday after criticism at the weekend for his appearance on the Bush Deep podcast. Must check that out, Bush Deep, remember that, with a comedian Nikki Osborne. Amid a light-hearted interview in which topics included Albanese's dog and gifts that he'd received from world leaders, the host asked Albanese in a rapid-fire question round to place Kylie Minogue, Nicole Kidman and Rhonda Birchmore in a shag, marry and date game. Have you heard of Rhonda Birchmore?
No.
She's she's an Australian entertainer.
Okay.
Obviously she's pretty hot, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Albanese was initially reluctant, responding, I just got married. I'm only 6 months in. And Nikki Osborne said, well, what if it all goes tits up? Let's just pretend. to which Albanese replied, Kylie, obviously. And Osborne said, you'd shag, date and marry Kylie? To which Albanese replied, all of the above. She's terrific. And Osborne then says, but aren't you and your wife bonking like rabbits? And Albanese replies, well, when we have time. After the footy, he goes on to say, it's always a good aphrodisiac when the rabbitos win. Bonking like rabbitos, he goes.
God, this is the Australian Prime Minister.
I'm just loving it. I mean, can you imagine Starmer loosening up like that?
No, but I can imagine Trump. He'd get quite disgusting, I suppose.
Yeah, Trump is beyond the pale.
Yes, he's Starmer, no. Absolutely. I mean, he's stone, really, isn't he?
Yeah, but you have to love Australia. Anyway, Janie, have you got anything interesting to say?
Oh, no, except for Lost Art of Giving Directions you had down as our next subject.
Oh, I do, yes.
You did, didn't you? What was all that about?
Well, it's a conversational art form that's in danger of disappearing, like the dodo. And it's already an endangered species in that you hear it less and less in this digital age. And I refer to the comforting and it's generally blokey because blokes tend to ask directions or give directions.
Sorry to interrupt. I think it's more of the give.
Giving directions.
Yes. They don't like asking where to go.
That's right. No, women women tend to get lost, don't they? And they ask blokes, do you know the way to Califor?
Yeah.
Okay, fair play, yeah. But it's a conversation, a communication skill that's becoming all but obsolete. And after a several-minute discourse of painstaking detail, landscapes, landmarks, turn left, turn right, straight ons, road names, numbers, pubs, bars, traffic lights, random memories, uphill, downhill, the intricate detail of a road often travelled, patently related to the long-suffering traveller, who asked innocently, do you know the way to Lower Bridlington? Have you ever done that and then become involved in an explanation that goes on?
Oh, yes. And then they repeat it. And they repoint.
Take the long right-hand bend, and right on the apex of the bend is a fallen tree. Yeah. It's been there for ages. Well, 150 yards after the tree is a left-hand turn. No, that's not the one you want. You want the right-hand turn at the beginning of the next bend, which is how far is it? It's about 200 yards in front of the left-hand turn. You can tell if it's a right because there's a yellow house on the corner.
Oh, my God.
When you take that right-hand turn, and as the road narrows, it gets quite windy. More of a lane, really.
But he sounds like he knows where he's going. I mean, I don't think many people do know where they're going anymore, which is why they can't give directions. And they rely on these pins and all this.
But how much of that have you remembered?
Oh, none of it, apart from some yellow building I'm not supposed to turn left at.
I know.
I am a visual person. I do like, you know, a signpost or, you know, something to look out for. I'm not very good at any other way. So when I'm describing where to go to somebody who's trying to maybe get to my house, if my son is around or another male, they tend to interrupt me and say, I'll tell them. And they take over and they say, you don't know how to give directions.
I think there's something in that.
Really?
Yeah. I think there is something in that. But I'll leave it there.
I just don't think you're as visual as maybe women are.
And I'm here in Spain too, where we love talking, but are generally not very good at listening to the answer. The appearance, aura, energy of your interlocutor, the person you've asked for directions, for example, is generally far more engaging, absorbing to the mind in the information he's imparting. You know, a bit like names. How often have you been introduced to somebody? Have you met John? And you shake hands and you may even say, hello, John. And within 90 seconds, you've absolutely no idea what he was called.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean,
the other one's gone in one ear, out the other.
Yes. I want to feel polite and ask someone their name. And I will be very honest, if I have met them before and I can't remember their name, and I'm terribly sorry. I can't remember your name.
Yes, it was only 60 seconds ago, but your name's completely escaped me.
Yes.
Because your brain is so busy absorbing and processing his impression. His name is really the least interesting thing about him. Don't you think that?
I think I asked because not because I so much want to know the name, but because I want to appear to be polite and to care about what their name is. But it doesn't actually go in.
I think you've got to use it immediately.
I think you do.
Hello, John. Nice to meet you, John.
Yeah.
John, where do you live?
Yeah.
How long have you been here, John?
Yeah. And then that can get extremely annoying and they don't want to know you anymore.
The But what about asking for directions here in Spain? Lost in a small town called Alcoy, Valencia province. Heavy traffic. Objective, bus station. You're dropping a friend. Deadline, 4 minutes. The bus leaves then and closing, as deadlines tend to. You're looking for a local. You wind the window down to address an apparently compos mentis anciano in a black cap, someone who looks super local. He's standing on the pavement. You hail him. He focuses. Hola, muy buenas. ¿Usted sabe por dónde se encuentra la estación del autobús? And he's been taken by surprise by an urgent giri in a hire car.
Who can speak Spanish.
Who speaks Spanish, but probably doesn't understand. It's probably in a different accent or something. But anyway, this is a random event which is gradually sinking in. He goes, ¿Qué me dice usted? And then you have to repeat the question. And then he goes, pues vamos a ver. Long pause as he looks up the road. The clock's ticking, yeah, as though the bus station were visible in the distance. Then he inclines his head through 180 degrees to look down the road. Time is ticking, and he's gripping his chin pensively, and in the interest of a more rapid response, you've begun scanning the sidewalk for a more orientated candidate, but this is now unfeasible because the old man has removed his hand from his chin and is now using it to support his weight on the windowsill of your car door, his face unnervingly close to your own. Pues, he says again, your friend and passenger, gaping at his watch with the bus disappearing, visualizing his bus to Alicante disappearing, is saying, come on, please, come on. And then the anciano utters that phrase, indispensable to those who find themselves, for one reason or another, unable to impart the direction you've just requested. He goes, bueno, soy de aquí.
I'm not
from here. And this is a very useful phrase, actually, when yes, you're a stranger and someone asks you the way to Sabadell Bank or somewhere.
Yes.
Or perhaps you are from there but have had a brainstorm and it's all too much, and you tell a tiny white lie.
Yes, that's good. But trying to decipher, I remember in a Spanish lesson actually being taught directions, how to understand them, you know, like siga enfrente and the rotondas, which are also glorietas,
yes,
the roundabouts,
yeah,
and the por la izquierda and por la derecha and enfrente and atrás and all those words. So
derecha is to the right,
yes,
and derecho is straight on,
is
which
it?
Is really muddling.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah. Yeah, so anyway.
I'm never going to get a grasp of Spanish.
Anyway, I used the word blokey just now because road directions really are the preserve of the male species. They were, but now you have American women on sat-nav telling you, which way to go, basically. But appalling. Yeah, have you ever had that on sat-nav?
Yes, this terrible, terrible English or American
continue
spoken
on
Cali Spanish.
And they'll see you in 600 metres. Take the right fork onto Carretera, N340, Avenida Don Paddy Carlos Joaquin. I mean, really.
And the way, I mean, I can't do it, but the way they say words we, you know, so common and used to, like Nuevo Andalucía, you know, they would say, how would they say it, Kit? I can't say.
Yeah, they get all the
Andalusia.
Something like that.
Yeah, and it sounds so peculiar. Okay. Hysterically funny. Anyway.
Look, we've got to take a break because it's, goodness me. It's,
yeah, we've been entertaining them too much,
32
Kit.
32 minutes past 11. And I'm hoping Terence Michaels is waiting up in Galcín to explain the vagaries of how the tides are affected by the moon.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Terence Michaels, the Sage of the Serenia, does tides, high and low. The Sage of the Serenia, Terence Michaels, and the moon now. Tell, good morning to you.
Hello, Kit. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you perfectly, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, it's a bit rough at this end.
We're super primitive. I've got my mobile pointing into the microphone.
Yeah, we're very high-tech here.
Super high-tech here in Camino. It's homegrown radio. How are you doing? How are you feeling?
I'm okay. Yeah, not brilliant. I've got a lot of damage to my lungs from the pneumonia. The attentive listener may remember we did a little thing from the hospital last February, and it's a consequence of that. And my heart's very dodgy. It's got four stents in it. Hopefully they're doing their job, but it does feel very tense. So right. Every day is a bonus.
Right. And I know you wanted to pay tribute again to the wonderful medical staff who've been looking after you.
Yeah, just very briefly, I was so impressed by the doctors and the nurses, really faultless. Not so impressed by the building, it was all airless and grey, but fantastic service. And also, incredible, really, if you think about the amount of money it would have cost me privately, it was probably about €50,000, all for free.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? That it's on the soap.
Yeah. Incredible. And as I say, absolutely marvellous service from this, especially the nurses, all so kind and helpful and, fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, and while we're on that point, I took a friend to Hospiten, the private hospital here in Estepona, the other day, and it was so crowded. It was like an airport departure lounge. There were people milling everywhere. I won't say Indian Railway Station, but it was. There was a serious concentration of humanity, and I was thinking, Rwanda Hospital's not like that.
No, it's remarkably calm and efficient. I've found I've never had any problems up there, really. Marvellous. Incidentally, Kit, I mentioned the cost. One of the drugs I found out yesterday, one of the drugs I take to keep my heart working is €88 every 2 weeks. And again, I get it, and that's just one of a dozen drugs I've been prescribed. So incredible, really, to get that, that for nothing.
€88.
Somebody's making money.
Right. So, how much did you say? €88 every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks, yeah. If I had to pay for it privately, and that's just one of them, Kit. There are several. I don't take them all because I don't like the side effects, but try and replace them with natural ones. But some are absolutely impressive, deeply essential. So, incredible. Yeah, I've got nothing but praise for the Spanish state at the moment, Kit, because every month my pension comes in, bless them, and this incredible treatment.
It sounds like very good value, man, to keep you alive. I mean, that works out at what? It's €18 a day or something.
What price life?
Let's talk a bit of science now. Because as I was explaining earlier, when Corey was on last week talking about the immense tidal range in Galicia and how it somehow is affected by the moon. And I Googled this, and I'm still really none the wiser. It talked about the Earth bulging at certain parts, drawn by the moon's gravitational pull. Are you able to elucidate on this?
It's like most things really are. On one level, you just summed it up completely, and there's not a lot more to be said. On another level, there's incredible details to go into, and so many factors affecting the high and low tides. You mentioned Galicia, but that's far from the highest. The highest one's in Canada, actually, and can go up to, I think, 16 metres. The lowest one is in Spain, which is sometimes as little as 30 centimetres. So incredible difference. And of course, the Bristol Channel, too, is famous for having high tides, up to 15 metres at certain times. But there's so, as I say, Kit, there's so many, there's so many factors affecting the actual nature of it. Do you know about apogee and perigee, Kit?
No.
lovely words, I think, but it just means that the furthest away that the moon ever is, that's the apogee, and the nearest, the perigee, is when it's at its nearest, and that can range from 407,000 kilometres at the furthest to 356 kilometres at the nearest, and obviously this has an effect on the gravity. The nearer, of course, the greater the gravity. So absolutely fascinating, I think. I've got lots of facts about the moon, Kit. Do you want to hear a few of them?
Right, I know. Janie had a question. I hope you can hear.
Hi, Terry. My question really, what is, how do you spell that word? Apogee and what was the other one?
Apogee and perigee. It's very easy to remember because you think apogee is when it's away, starting with an A, and perigee is when it's more personal, it's nearer. So
that's
perigee.
That's
lovely
handy
words.
Right. So to get back to the moon and the tides, the moon exerts a gravitational pull on the Earth. How are you able to explain that?
Well, it's the nature of gravity. You know that any body exerts pressure on other bodies depending on its size and mass. Newton worked out many years ago the formulas for it, but it's straightforward enough. The bigger an object, the greater its mass, and therefore, generally speaking, the more gravitational pull it has. This explains why you get such variations in the tides, in part because if you can imagine when the sun and moon are aligned, that increases the gravitational pull. When the moon's on the other side of the Earth, that decreases the gravitational pull, but that's only marginally. There are so many other factors involved. But the moon's a fascinating place. Well, of course, all planets or planetary bodies are fascinating.
Yeah,
if you're in that sort of thing.
I was going to say, tell us some fascinating things about the moon. Apart from the fact that it can control tides.
First of all, it's not really a sphere; it's more lemon shaped, and there again, that's all down to gravity when it was being formed. There are earthquakes, moonquakes, which not people know about, which are, can be very strong. It smells apparently like gunpowder. This was discovered on the suits of astronauts when they came back in 1969. And it's going away from us. This I find absolutely fascinating. It's actually going away from us at the rate at which the human fingernail grows. That's about 3.8 centimetres a year. So eventually it'll be so far away that it won't... have much of a gravitational pull on us at all, but that's millions of years away from now. But at one point, it was 20,000 kilometres away from the Earth. That's almost nothing, and the gravitational pull was phenomenal, causing a massive tides to make today's tides look pathetic, really.
Okay, so the tides are generally diminishing as the moon grows as the moon departs at the rate of the growth of a fingernail.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, as I said, millions of years before it's going to cause a problem, and I don't think it'll be a problem for you and me, or the dear listener. But interestingly, you know, when you look up at the moon, it appears to be exactly the same size as the sun. And that's because although it's 400 times less wide, it's much, much nearer. So 400 times nearer, in fact. So there's only a few million years of the Earth's history in which this will be the case, which is, again, I think, absolutely phenomenal. And, of course, it gives us these wonderful effects when there's a lunar eclipse, because the moon fits exactly over the sun. It's fascinating.
Yes, of course. And we've got a major eclipse coming up, haven't we? And not in this part of Spain, but in the north.
So I gather. Yeah, the last one, 2024, we missed that as well. I'd love to see it, Kit, but I don't think I'll be able to.
But won't we see part of it? Won't we see part of the... I mean, we won't see the full eclipse, but it will be partial down this way, no?
I assume so, but possibly not enough to particularly noticeable.
In the TRE area, Valencia gets it, the Balearics get it.
Yeah.
It's in a swathe that enters Spain on the northwest Cape and is a diagonal.
Yeah,
that cuts
clips.
Yes.
Yeah, it kind of clips Spain, I mean, if I could, I'd go to see it, but fortunately it's not possible.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So the moon is an incredible thing, really. It's 4.5 billion years ago when the planet Earth was forming. There was a massive... another planet called Theia, which smashed into the young Earth and caused an enormous plume of debris, gases, dust and so forth, which eventually spun itself into what we now call the moon. But, it would have been an amazing thing to see had there been a human being to see it.
Yes. And so the moon is a derivative of, did you say Theia?
Theia was a proto-planet, in the early solar system. There was lots of debris flowing around, but some of it clumped up into what's now called proto-planets. Not real, what we would now see as a planet. And one of them crashed into the young Earth, causing it was huge, it got massive. And you have to imagine the impact was phenomenal. If you look on Google, you can get images of it, and it really is very, very impressive.
Can I ask another question?
Terry,
just one other. I am absolutely fascinated by the idea that there is one, you know, there are areas that do have these very extreme tides. For example, as you say, in the, you know, the River Avon, the Bristol Channel, that sort of area. Is there a simple, is there anything that has a big influence that you know of that you can tell us about that's causing that to happen as opposed to down here? I mean, we all sit under the same moon. So what is it?
In enclosed bodies of water such as the Mediterranean, the tide can be as little as 30 centimetres. That's because it's not affected in the same way it's a smaller body of water, so it's not affected as intensely as the large bodies of water like the Atlantic or the Pacific. So that's the main reason, really. As I say, it, on one level, as Kit said, it's very, very simple. It's just the moon pulling on the water. But on another level, when you dig into it, there's so many other factors involved. As I say, the other gravitational influences of the sun and the moon when they are on the same side of the planet, as it were, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Okay. I mean, so it's
the more you look, the more you find.
The movement of water in a teaspoon as opposed to, you know, a great big bucket or a bath.
Yeah.
All right, I get
excellent,
that.
Jane, that's a very, very good analogy. That's an excellent analogy. Yeah, that's basically,
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, Terry, thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it now because we are actually going back to the seashore after the next break because Janie's got a bee in her bonnet about seaweed. So that's going to be exciting.
I feed it to my cannabis plants.
Yes, I think she's going to talk about that.
Cannabis.
No, the amino acids.
I don't know if she grows cannabis, but she's definitely going to talk about it as a compostable thing. A bit of a spoiler alert, really. So I don't want to spoil the tension.
Okay, I should point out that I do so legally. The law in Spain is sensible, I think, or reasonably sensible.
Okay, we won't send the police up then.
enormous pleasure, Kit.
Yeah, absolutely lovely as ever to talk to you. What can I say except hasta la próxima?
Sí, muy bien.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
Espero que sobre vivo.
Sí, yo también. Venga, hasta luego.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
Yes, we all know what this is. It's the part of the show we call Things That Grow. And without further ado, Janie, give us the lowdown on seaweed.
Well, as Terry was just saying, it makes flipping good fertiliser.
And it's free.
And it's free.
Is it free, or can you get arrested by some?
Oh, I don't know if you can get arrested, but you can get looked at real funny if you go down the beach and you're dressed with two buckets and a garden fork and start scooping it in, and you're in front of all the sunbathers and they think you're completely bonkers.
Do you know the last time I went to the beach, I was invited by a friend to come and get some seaweed.
I wonder who that was.
And I got down there and I scanned the beach and I thought, phew, she's not there. So I went for a swim. And then lay down and had a sleep in the sun afterwards, and woke up to find this batty woman with a large tub, wearing gumboots and a fork, standing over me, blocking my sun. I mean, yes, Jenny, you do get some strange looks.
Not entirely true.
You look kind of agricultural in the middle of a sort of scenario.
I must have looked like a complete lunatic, but it's good stuff. You did have to help me carry it back to the car, though, because I wasn't there in time to pick up what had been left on the beach by the sea the night before. The whole beach was And I'm sure if you've walked along these beaches around Gibraltar, Cadiz, Costa del Sol, or even in Portugal, you will have seen great mats of this stuff, this brown, smelly seaweed, actually piled up on the beaches and, of course, in the water too. So enjoying the beach is not fun. You can't really. It is not nice to go in the water when it's like that. And it has been piling up all along these beaches. It's an invasive species which is taking over the whole med. There's another one that is another form of seaweed that's come from the Sargasso Sea in the Atlantic that is now covering the beaches all along and has been for years along the Mexican coast and all down all around and in Africa and all the way the north and south of America. It's causing real problems to tourism, to marine life, and also now in the Mediterranean. It was first the species that we have here is not the floating type like it is in the Atlantic, which has little kind of pockets of air. You know, those little
poppable
things. That's a floating kind of seaweed. This isn't a floating one. It actually roots itself on the rocks underwater.
Are you talking about the predator seaweed?
We're talking about the invasive seaweeds.
Invasive seaweed.
That don't come from this area. This particular one that we have in the Med is native to Japan, Korea, China, that sort of area. The scientists reckon it's come in on the hulls of ships and in their ballast water. And because it breaks off into tiny fragments, it can grow into entirely new plants and travel for a long distance, where it then grows incredibly rapidly. And these sea currents can carry these fragments for miles, hence it's got into the Med.
What damage does it do?
Well, very few native marine animals can eat it, for a start. Mm-hmm. It's really grows so fast, like thick carpets underwater. It's filling up the fishing nets. It's preventing some boats from going out. It's reducing the biodiversity and altering the habitats that the fish, shellfish and many other marine creatures do depend on. But, of course, it's not just that. It's affecting our coastal areas in terms of tourism, being able to use the beaches. And this is happening more and more often. It's happening earlier in the year, and the times that the seaweed is coming in is becoming, it's almost happening all year. You don't need a storm.
Because of the rising sea temperatures,
exactly.
I imagine, as well.
Exactly. And the councils have been spending thousands, millions of euros every year removing it. So, if you've gone near it, you'd have smelt it. So, you know, it's hardly very enticing in the summer. So it's not good for the tourism, as I said. And it does seem that some people are saying we can't get rid of it. There's no way of stopping this. But what is being used for is for agriculture. It's being used for fertilisers. They're looking into whether it can be converted into biofuels, biodegradable materials, packaging, fertilisers, and even valuable compounds for industry. But trying to turning around what's an environmental problem into something that we can use in our economy is one thing, but actually trying to get rid of it is what we really need to try and do.
Well, you're on the beach with your bucket and your fork, and loading it into buckets, and so that's helping a little bit, Janie. But tell us...
Two soggy buckets, and there's mountains of this stuff.
Okay, so it's free and it's compostable.
It is.
And what's the recipe? You put it in your buckets, you load the buckets into the car, then are you drying the seaweed out before you apply it in the garden? Let's move to the garden now.
Okay, I've dried some out and I'm mixing that into my compost that I've actually got, you know, composting from my vegetable waste. I've also soaked some, a bucket load in water and left it for a few days and then drained it off, and I've got this rich, stinky sludgy, wet, brown stuff, which I've now put on my tomatoes, in the soil around my tomatoes and some of my trees. It's very, very rich and very good.
It reminds me a little bit, or the sound of it reminds me a little bit of Baby Bio. Do you remember those little bottles you could buy in Britain?
It's just like that, actually.
Right. Maybe that's what Baby Bio was.
Maybe it is. I mean, it is vegetable
matter.
You poured
it onto houseplants.
Yeah. So anyway, but there is some good news because there has been some in terms of, you know, getting this seaweed out of the Mediterranean, and that is by introducing another seaweed, which is actually native. It's being looked into by the Invadamar project. And this other seaweed is called Gongolaria, which also grows very nicely and will actually, it produces a compound, chemical compound known as phenolic acid or something like that, that spreads into the surrounding water and stops this Rugolopteryx seaweed from growing.
Rugolopteryx is the bad one.
Yes. It sounds like a Japanese dinosaur, doesn't
Rugolopteryx.
It? The whole name is Rugolopteryx okamore.
Okay. But it's the Gongolaria that we like.
It is that one.
The Gongolaria is being cultivated and introduced specifically to compete with the Rugolopteryx.
In certain areas, yes. And, of course, it needs support from governments and industry and all sorts of people in order to keep those explorations going and to make it actually happen. So
okay. But
maybe
in the meantime, the Rugolopteryx will work on your garden.
Yes, it will. It's marvellous.
Is that any seaweed?
It will, and we can eat it, but I'm not sure if we can eat that one.
Oh, okay. Right. We can get onto recipes another time.
Eat it once it's gotten the vegetables.
I'm imagining, yeah. Seaweed. What was that seaweed, the dry seaweed that came in leaves that you'd buy?
Nori.
Oh, so good.
Isn't it?
I love that.
Yeah, it's a sushi wrap.
Yes, I love that in... I love that, and on omelettes. Thanks very much to Don for sending a whole bunch of jokes about a place called Lepe in Huelva, where obviously people are cerebrally challenged. He says two people from Lepe are driving. They come to a red light and stop. It turns green and they don't move. Somebody behind them honks, and one of them says, "Don't worry, it will come green again." So thanks for that, John. And thanks very much to Angela Sharp for getting in touch. It's been lovely having your company, and we wish you all a very happy weekend. And that's all we have.
Yes, and if you're watching it, enjoy the football.
Oh, yes. Janie will be watching it, yeah.
And Kit won't.
Our football pundit, yeah, I don't have a TV. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.